Stand by while NCLA cuts through the noise to signal abuse of administrative power. This is Administrative Static with Mark Chenoweth and John Vecchione.
Welcome back to Administrative Static. This is Mark Chenoweth with John Vecchione, and we have a special guest with us today. Our colleague Harriet Hageman is on the line. Harriet is one of the senior litigation counsel at the New Civil Liberties Alliance. Pleased to have you join us today, Harriet.
Thank you, Mark. I'm pleased to be here.
And the reason why Harriet is with us today is because we have an exciting victory at the New Civil Liberties Alliance. And Harriet's on a roll. This is her second victory in 2 months. So she's been doing fantastic. I think we told our listeners about your Laramie County Planning Commission victory about a month or so ago. But tell us what's happening in your case, RCAF against the U.S. Department of Agriculture. What is it that the USDA did this week that has NCLA declaring victory?
Well, thank you, Mark. And it was quite a victory. Just to give a bit of background, in 2019, USDA issued a guidance document called a fact sheet that they posted on their website, and reversing or nullifying a properly adopted rule from 2013, this fact sheet actually required all of our livestock producers to start using radio frequency identification ear tags starting on January 1, 2023. Obviously, this was of great concern to NCLA and our clients, who are ranchers in a trade organization, a livestock trade organization. And so we filed a lawsuit challenging the legality of that fact sheet. And within about 30 days after we filed the lawsuit, the USDA actually withdrew it, which was a victory in October of 2019. But that wasn't the end of the story. We knew that USDA, as well as the packers and the ear tag manufacturing companies, recognized that this is something that they were going to push forward with no matter what the livestock producers actually wanted. And so in July of 2020, USDA issued a notice in the Federal Register saying that they were going to not necessarily mandate RFID ear tags, but if you did use an ear tag, it had to be RFID compliant. The vast majority of our livestock producers use ear tags. And so it was just another workaround trying to, again, nullify that 2013 regulation. And so
now for our audience who aren't ranchers, I know, you know, you grew up on a ranch, Harriet, so these terms are all familiar to you. But for those of our audience who did not, can you explain how big of a process it is to brand cattle or put in these ear tags, or if you were to have to redo all this for your whole herd, does that involve a lot of cost and time and effort, or is that a fairly easy process?
It would be astronomically expensive. According to the USDA, their estimate is that it would be over $2 billion to comply with this particular fact sheet and requirement. And from the standpoint of technology and feasibility, I grew up on a large ranch about 100 miles north of Cheyenne, Wyoming, and our clients run cattle in both South Dakota and Wyoming.
And these are the foxes and the hunts, by the way, which I love that because they're the two easiest clients names to remember, the foxes and the hunts.
Yes, they are. And they run on, the hunts run on a common allotment north of Newcastle, Wyoming, and it's thousands and thousands of acres. And having to gather the cattle, put in the RFID ear tags, having the wands and the internet access and the capacity to actually even do that, again, I doubt that it's feasible. That was something that the USDA recognized, but simply ran over the top of, if you will, when they initially issued this fact sheet. We'd have some serious technological as well as the working of the cattle themselves that would make it extremely difficult and costly, which is one of the issues. But the other issue is, again, a form of surveillance. Our federal government simply does not have the right, if you will, to be involved in running livestock operations and dictating how cattle and bison are managed. And so there were a wide variety of property issues associated with this as well. But again, USDA didn't want to give up. So in July of 2020, they issued a notice in the Federal Register requiring that if you did use an AirTag, it had to be RFID compliant. Both our clients as well as NCLA itself filed comments, again talking about the illegality of that rule because it wasn't a rulemaking. The illegality of that announcement, and it wasn't a rulemaking. And yesterday...
Right, so USDA was essentially trying to replace a 2013 rule with just some guidance or announcements or fact sheets, things that didn't go through formal notice and comment rulemaking.
That's exactly right. They were they under the 2013 regulation, livestock producers are allowed to use brands, ear tags, back tags, group identification numbers, and tattoos. And again, to try to force them into this one very narrow type of identification, being the RFID ear tags, they said, okay, we're not gonna mess with the rest of the rule. But if in fact you do use ear tags, they have to be RFID compliant. So they were violating the law. They violated the APA, which is what we pointed out in our comments.
And that's the Administrative Procedure Act for the uninitiated.
Yes, it is. And on Tuesday of this week, they issued an announcement saying that after reviewing 944 public comments on a July 2020 notice, the proposed to approve radio frequency identification as the official ear tag for use in interstate movement of cattle, they have decided to actually go through a formal rulemaking process if they move forward with this, which was the argument that NCLA was making the entire time.
That almost sounds like a well. First of all, congratulations! The fantastic.
Thank you.
That's a great job. The way you described it, it almost sounded like one of these, the official ear tag sponsor of the NFL kind of things. But yeah, it's a big deal that the USDA has backed down from what it was trying to do, which was take a regulatory shortcut. Now they're going to have to, if they want this policy in place, they're going to have to go through the normal notice and comment rulemaking process that you have to go through in order to replace one rule with another rule. And if they do that, then our clients and all the other ranchers in America will have an opportunity, a fair opportunity to weigh in and try to explain why going down this path is not a good idea. Is that fair to say?
It is fair to say. And in fact, when they started this in 2011, that's how long this has been going on, that this battle has been happening. They tried to do RFID ear tags way back in 2011, and there was such incredible pushback from the livestock industry that when they issued the 2013 regulation, they specifically approved the traditional forms of identification that our livestock producers use. Again, the branding, tattoos, ear tags, back tags, that sort of thing. So they know that the livestock industry itself, the regulated industry, is adamantly opposed to this regulation. And that's why they keep trying to do to circumvent the rules, to circumvent the Administrative Procedures Act, circumvent notice, and that sort of thing. I do want to go back to one thing you said a moment ago about that it was an AirTag company being the sponsor. Interestingly enough, the president of one of the manufacturers of an RFID AirTag companies was the chair of the committee that has been pushing this through.
No.
Yes. That might surprise you.
Well.
But it is the packers and the ear tag manufacturing companies. They're the ones that want the RFID ear tags, not the actual people who run cattle.
Yeah. Well, and I don't know if we'll have time to get into this. We might have to have you back to discuss this part. But I know that your lawsuit is continuing against the USDA because under a different set of rules involving the Federal Advisory Committee Act, the advisory committee that USDA used to help inform it before putting this guidance into place was stacked with ear tag manufacturers and stacked against the ranchers. Anybody who opposed the idea of using these ear tags was excluded from the committee, as I understand it.
That's absolutely correct. And in fact, late last night, the USDA filed their brief in response to our opening brief in the FACA case. And what has been going on there is that the USDA put together the Cattle Traceability Working Group. That's what the organization was. And one of our clients, Kenny Fox, was actually on that working group. But they refused to agree with the idea of forcing livestock producers to use RFID ear tags. So USDA disbanded them in April of 2019 and put together the Producers Traceability Council. And that was all pro-RFID folks. And so that's how USDA has been able to argue that ostensibly they have the support of the industry, but it's not the cattle industry that they have the support of. But yes, we are pursuing that because they violated the transparency and accountability requirements associated with the Federal Advisory Committee Act.
Right. One of the things that the Federal Advisory Committee Act requires, if you're going to have one of these federal advisory committees, is that it be fairly representative of folks on both sides of the issue or all sides of the issue. And then there are certain requirements about making your meeting minutes public and public notice about your meetings and those sorts of things. And the Producers Traceability Council, I take it, didn't do any of those things that FACA requires.
They didn't do any of those things. And in fact, PTC especially has been quite murky in terms of some of the work that they've been doing and continuing to do behind the scenes. So it is
almost sounds like a smoke-filled room.
I think that's probably a very accurate description of it. Cigars and all. So yes, that is that's the problem with what they've done. So the way that I describe this case is you've got a coyote and a wolf sitting at the table with a lamb trying to discuss what they're going to have for dinner.
Yeah. And I take it ranchers are on the menu. So
that's right.
Well, again, congratulations on your excellent work in this case. It's nice to see. And look, I'll give some credit to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. They could have continued to fight this, but I think they saw the writing on the wall, and they have now backed down and said that they're going to do things differently. And do you have any sense of why that is? Is it just the pressure? Was there any final argument that sealed the deal, or just hard to read into the mind of a bureaucrat?
I'm going to put a plug in for NCLA. I think that they knew that we were going to continue to fight this issue.
Fantastic. Well, again, thank you very much, Harriet. Thanks for being with us here on Administrative Static.
Thank you, Mark.
Welcome back to Administrative Static. Normally, we don't talk about cases that the Supreme Court turns down, but this week they turned down the case of Massachusetts Lobstermen's Association versus Gina Raimondo, Secretary of Commerce. And
I'm pretty sure that's lobstermen.
Lobster. There's no question that that's how they say it. So it's the thing of. I just want to read the very first few lines of this statement by John Roberts. So they deny certiorari. The Supreme Court says, we're not taking this case. And here's what he says.
Now, is this a concurrence, or this is a dissent from the denial?
It's just a statement. He agrees.
Just a statement. Okay.
He's telling all the lawyers like us, we're really interested in this. And if you get the right case, we really want to look at it because something's rotten in the state of Denmark. Or at least off the coast of
Greenland,
exactly.
which is part of Denmark.
Which of the following is not like the others? A, a monument. B, an antiquity defined as a relic or monument of ancient times. Or C, 5,000 square miles of land beneath the ocean. If you answered C, you are not only correct, but also a speaker of ordinary English. And so Roberts notes this. So here's in this case, the government.
Now what if Atlantis was at the bottom of the ocean in this case?
That would be an antiquity.
Right? Okay, now I might buy that
out
one.
There with Prince Namor or something, but yeah.
Yeah, right, or the Colossus of Rhodes or something.
In this case, however, the government has relied on the Antiquities Act of 1906 to designate an area of submerged land about the size of Connecticut as a monument, the Northeast Canyons and Seamounts Marine National Monument. Now, you think about this for a second. All you have to do is put monument at the end of the name of whatever you want to name, and it presto changeo, it's a monument. So
the John Vecchione Homestead Monument.
There you go. There you go. And then nothing can be done. Now, this 1906... That's Teddy Roosevelt as president. And what happens is there are all these people disturbing graves and antiquities in the West, particularly the Pueblo Indian sites. Some of these are thousands of years old, and people are going in and taking stuff and doing things. And Congress says, okay, the president can name someplace an important antiquity or monument. And then if, as long as he, and this is the important thing, as long as he contains it to the smallest area necessary to preserve it, he can name something an antiquity, and it gets certain, or a monument, it gets certain protections. So Teddy Roosevelt did that because obviously he's big on the West and preserving its monuments and its nature and its history. So, but in, since 2005, mind you, just 15 years ago, presidents have named more land under the Antiquities Act as monuments than in all 100 years prior to this. I guess I should say 99 years, right? 1906 to 2005.
Yeah.
Then all 99 years. And Roberts points this out. And this is huge administrative overreach, because what the presidents do is they wait till the last year of their term or the last 2 years of their term. And then they name something to get, you know, to help their legacy.
Because it's highly popular and they want to go out with a super popular action. That's why they wait till the very end of their term to do this.
Well, exactly. It's popular amongst some part of their base or somebody they want to please, and not popular amongst, you know, people who could actually pass a law.
Yeah. And the or could size, actually use the land.
And the size, exactly. Here they cut off fishing, you know, and it's been held for a while. But in another case, Bear's Ears, the real question was not, is this a religious or historic site? It's how big are you going to make it? So if you have a piece of land.
And this is Bear's Ears National Monument in southern Utah, if I remember correctly.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay.
And so the question is, how big do you make it? And the other issue that comes up in these cases, which is very fascinating, is some legal scholars and some environmentalists and people like that say that the president, after he declares a site in antiquities, cannot reduce the size of it. Basically, the statute gives him unilateral ability to name anything a relic, anything in antiquity of any size, but no subsequent president can reduce the size and say
it's
no.
It's a
one-way ratchet. And so these decisions have never been decided by the Supreme Court. And what Roberts is saying here is, wait a minute. The size of Connecticut? He just named a relic or a monument the size of Connecticut.
That's one big relic.
Exactly. And the other thing is, it's not clear to me, or it wasn't when I was looking at this case. I mean, it's not clear to me that you're even allowed to make the seabed or the ocean where some of this land is. We have fishing rights and certain rights there, but whether or not it's even fully U.S. territory under international law or it's covered by the statute, maybe. Whether it's covered by the statute is very up in the air. So there were tons and tons of questions here. It has huge economic impact, huge cultural impact, and it's not clear that it's the smallest site necessary. And that's what Roberts is focusing on here. And he almost never does this. We talked, I think it was last week, Mark, but
in
the past. Roberts doesn't like to speak alone. He wants to speak for unanimous courts. He wants a majority. He does not like to speak alone. But
although he dissented on something by himself earlier this year, right?
Correct.
Eight to one decision.
And that was the first time in 15, 20 years he's been on the bench on the Supreme Court. He's never done it before. So in this case, he's done it again. He's made a statement, and he's basically telling the profession and people like Mark and I and folks over at Pacific Legal Foundation and other nonprofits or other people who are affected by these in the business world, hey, look, there's important issues here and we need to look at them. But we're not going to look at them until the circuit courts have fully all taken a look and see whether it's split decisions or whether they've made it. So you have the normal.
He wants some percolation.
He wants some percolation. That's exactly it. He says this, you know, despite these concerns, this petition does not satisfy our usual criteria for granting certiorari. And then he explains what they are. No court of appeals has addressed the questions raised above about how to interpret the Antiquities Act's smallest area compatible requirement, you know, compatible with preserving the monument. The D.C. Yeah. Circuit below held the petitioners did not plead sufficient facts to assess their claim that the monument swept beyond the smallest area compatible with the management of the ecosystem. To date, petitioners have not suggested what this critical statutory phrase means or what standard might guide our review of the president's actions in this area. And at the present time, the issue whether to reinstate the fishing prohibition remains under consideration. So I think because the fishing prohibition wasn't there, they had, it sounds to me like standing. I've forgotten the D.C. case. But see, the Supreme Court only likes to take things that have been fully buttoned down so that they're not arguing over what happened. They're saying this happened, and now this is going to be the rule of law because we're the Supreme Court, and that's what we do. But we don't go around fiddling around with what the facts are. So it sounds like they didn't really think this was a good vehicle. But boy, is it a big issue, because if you can, you know, Connecticut is not even the smallest state in the union, and so if you can make antiquities that big, the whole entire West, everything, you know, west of the Mississippi, particularly, is public land.
You grew up on the East Coast, Vec, right. I grew up in Kansas, but
High school in Connecticut.
Well, there's almost no federal land in Kansas. I mean, we've got some military bases and so forth, but there aren't any of these sort of giant national parks and that kind of thing. There's the tall grass prairie, but that was even that I think was designated in the 1990s. So, but my point is, folks in the East don't understand. And if you ever look at a map of the Western United States and how much of it is federal land, it is absolutely unbelievable the percentage of the Western states that are controlled and managed by the federal government. It is unbelievable. It would be like taking the state of Connecticut and basically taking two counties, like say the county where Hartford is and the county where New Haven is, and then the rest of the state would be federal land. I mean, that's almost what it looks like in some of these Western states. It's unbelievable.
There's no question. 98% of Connecticut is private or owned by Connecticut. 98%. And so that, I mean, Idaho would kill for that. Years ago, I represented a taxi company that only wanted a little radio thing. It was as big as my thumb so that it could do dispatching. And I had to go to the Bureau of Land Management to put a thumb-sized transistor on a tower they had because Boise didn't own any mountains that would allow them to actually have a transistor that size reach any part of Boise. I mean, wow. That is incredible that you can't even have, they had none of the high ground, no towers, no nothing. So really, you're absolutely right about this. And so not only is so much owned by the federal government, but that they can then, not even by Congress, you know, oftentimes we have these big fights over Alaska, is there going to be oil development or not? But Congress weighs in. They make laws all the time. Every couple of years, they say, well, you can do this, or you can do that. But in this case, the president himself can do this. And then interested people can say, even if subsequent president tries to undo it or make it smaller or more rational or less economically damaging, somebody else can come in and say, no, you're not allowed. You don't have that presidential power. So
isn't there a federalism problem here too, Vec? I mean, if I think about Bear's Ears, this is Obama acting in the state of Utah, or before that, Bill Clinton. I think it was the Grand Escalante National Monument again in Utah. So you're talking about a couple of Democrat presidents who did not win the state of Utah when either one of them ran any of the four times that they won together. And the state of Utah could make this a state protected area if it want to, but it chose not to do that. But you have the big foot of the federal government coming in an area where these presidents, you know, didn't enjoy much Democratic support, small D Democratic support, and interfering with local land management decision making.
And that is a big issue here, because also it's not the federal government. It is one branch of the federal government doing this. And I really think that the sort of Indiana Jones type grave robbing and stuff that was going on in Pueblo in 1906 was not an inconsequential problem. We might have nothing left. But once again, the government took an inch and went miles, square miles bigger than Connecticut.